vacationing on the shores of Lake Winnipeg.
You see signs of that sort of courtship practice going on at Winnipeg Beach.
A conversation with Dale Barber about the history of Winnipeg Beach. I'm Sean Courage, and you're listening to episode 28 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. In the late decades of the 19th century, urban North Americans sought refuge from congestion, noise, and pollution. As the environmental problems of industrial cities grew, city councils across the continent established urban parks, while federal governments in both Canada and the United States developed national parks systems. Parks, as constructed natural spaces, were just one option for city dwellers seeking relief from the polluted urban environment. Many flocked to the shores of oceans, lakes, and rivers, where beachside resorts emerged as yet another recreational destination. At the beginning of the 20th century, Winnipeggers turned to the shores of Lake Winnipeg to the north of the city in the hopes of finding an outlet for their leisure time. There, the Canadian Pacific Railway established the beachside resort community of Winnipeg Beach. For more than half a century, Winnipeg Beach was one of the most popular destinations for recreational tourists from Manitoba's urban population. Thousands of people enjoyed the lake views and boardwalk entertainments of Winnipeg Beach for many years until the community went into decline by the end of the 1960s. To learn more about the rise and fall of Winnipeg Beach, I spoke with Dale Barber, author of the recently published book, Winnipeg Beach, Leisure and Courtship in a Resort Town, 1900 to 1967.
My name is Dale Barber. I'm with the University of Toronto, graduate student.
Dale, thanks for joining us to talk to us about your book, Winnipeg Beach, Leisure and Courtship in a Resort Town, 1900 to 1967. I guess a good place to start for listeners is to maybe set up some of the geography here. Where exactly is Winnipeg Beach?
Winnipeg Beach is about 45 minutes north of Winnipeg. You head straight up to Lake Winnipeg, and Winnipeg Beach is right on the southern end of it.
Now, this isn't something we would have to explain to Manitoba listeners. I'm assuming Manitoba listeners would be eminently familiar with this place.
Yeah, no. If you're from Manitoba, you know where Winnipeg Beach is, and you know where Grand Beach is, and you're kind of familiar with the terrain of all these resorts that were a big deal at the beginning of the 20th century, but still well known today. So you either know them from your own personal experience, or you know them from the reputation of kind of what they used to be like.
So, what as a historian, what drew your attention to Winnipeg Beach?
I guess the first thing that drew my attention was less a historian and more just being out in that area. I actually grew up in the South Interlake. And my family used to go to Winnipeg Beach when I was a kid. It was only about 40 minutes away, so we'd go there periodically. And Winnipeg Beach I saw was kind of the Winnipeg Beach after its glory days had gone by. This was in the 1970s. So in that time in particular, it was kind of a low point for the community. All the recreation equipment, all the boardwalk had been removed. There used to be a dance hall there. There used to be a different rides. There used to be a roller coaster. All that sort of thing. It was gone by the time I got there. There were still a few games rooms and different things like that. So but I could hear the stories of what Winnipeg Beach used to be like from my parents who used to go there. So I kind of wondered, you know, well, what happened to this place? You know, what happened to the glory days, and you know, why did they have to go, that sort of thing.
And in a sense, that's precisely what your book covers then, the period of its origins to its peak to its decline. So why don't we start at the beginning then? How did Winnipeg Beach get its start as a recreational resort destination for urban dwellers in Manitoba?
In this case, we have to blame the Canadian Pacific Railway.
Isn't that always the case with Western Canadian history?
It's a good part of it, yeah. Although in this case, I think they were fairly happy with what the CPR ended up creating. The about 1900, 1901, the CPR, the vice president at the time, you know, made a little boat trip up the shores of South Lake Winnipeg and said, okay, where is a good spot for a resort that's close enough to Winnipeg that we can get people up there and we can get them back. Mm-hmm. So it can be a nice day trip resort. So they come along, and it wasn't named this yet, but they come along Winnipeg Beach and they find this 3-mile stretch of sand. And it was really a good-looking good-looking beach at the time. And they said, okay, here's our spot. And various people on the trip also bought land around there, so they ended up turning a nice little profit on that trip. But that was how they found it.
And so the intent was to create a perhaps day trip or short weekend trip, recreational destination for city dwellers from Winnipeg.
Exactly, and cabins as well. You can see from the first plans, they had a notion that, okay, we're going to have cabins up here. So immediately was divided into cabin lots as well. So that was part of the initial plan. And you can see the original discussions about it. They figured, okay, well, you know, we'll maybe have one or two trains up here a day, that sort of thing. So I don't think they anticipated huge crowds. The notion was that people would go up there, they'd kind of, you know, wander about in this great natural setting. They'd take in the lake and look around and do that sort of thing. And maybe there'd be a bandstand or something like that.
So what role did the natural environment of Winnipeg Beach play in the development, early development of the resort town?
It was the, it was the incentive to go there. It was, the natural environment was the draw. It was the magnet for the CPR. Mm-hmm. The notion, okay, we'll get people out of the dirty urban environment and give them this natural setting where they can refresh themselves.
Now, listeners might be familiar with the CPR's role in developing national parks in Western Canada, but this is a different kind of recreational area at Winnipeg Beach. You've described it as a resort, something like Coney Island?
Yeah, definitely. It was. It referred to itself, self-consciously as the Coney Island of the West, as pretty much every other resort across North America did at some point or another. But it was. But that's how it quickly developed into that. Initially, it wasn't necessarily that, but it quickly developed into this Coney Island type resort. And I mentioned, initially they thought there'd be one or two trains heading up there a day. In about 10 years, there was 17 trains might head up there in one day.
Wow. So let's think about the trains for a second here. What role did the train line play in developing the Winnipeg Beach Resort area?
There's this great little story in the Telegram about a reporter heading up there. And it took him about 16 hours to get up there. He went up there with a horse and carriage. And it... it was this epic journey, and he's describing every step of this journey. And he gets up there, and he spends a little while, and then he heads back, and he ends up taking a canoe for part of the trip back, and he gets lost in the delta of the Red River. And, it's a 36-hour round trip. I mean, that's what getting to Winnipeg Beach was like in 1901 before the train came along. So the train made it possible as a destination.
So Winnipeg Beach sounds like it was quite isolated then from the city itself. The train was the only conduit in and out of the resort?
Yeah, certainly at the time. I mean, there's another media story kind of the early days. Some people missed the last train back, and so they said, well, okay, we'll walk back. But the train station guy goes, no, you can't walk back. You'll surely be eaten by bears. So they ended up taking a boat back, because you could take a boat to Selkirk and then get a train from Selkirk to Winnipeg. Selkirk is north of Winnipeg on the Red River.
And just to put this into contemporary perspective, how long is the drive to Winnipeg Beach today from Winnipeg?
It's about 45 minutes, maybe an hour, it's somewhere in that range. And the train used to be able to do it in about 70 minutes.
So your book describes the beach, the physical environment of the beach itself, is a kind of physical liminal zone between land and water, but also a social liminal zone, that Winnipeg Beach as a resort emerged as a meeting place for people from various class and ethnic backgrounds?
Yeah, I mean, the concept of a beach as a liminal zone is kind of always the classic interpretation we have of what beaches are like. This meeting between nature and culture and the beach that's right at the center of that, and it kind of enables people to play with the rules, to break them a little. It's probably a little simplistic way of looking at the beach, but we can see how in a place like Winnipeg Beach, it becomes a boundary point in so many other ways. It becomes this boundary point where men and women can meet. And particularly at the beginning of the 20th century, that wasn't necessarily an easy thing to do. Hmm. There was very much restrictions on how men and women could meet and how they could be together and, you know, how they were supposed to behave in public. And we can even see it as a boundary point for Winnipeg's different ethnicities to meet as well, because certainly at the time, I mean, Winnipeg was probably the most ethnically diverse city in Canada. And yet those people went up to Winnipeg Beach, and certainly in the recreation area, if not the cabin area, they managed to get along.
Now, you make a persuasive argument in this book that the development of Winnipeg Beach was profoundly shaped by broader cultural changes in practices of courtship between men and women. Can you explain for listeners what some of the early practices of courtship were like at the beginning of the 20th century at Winnipeg Beach?
Yeah, my argument is really that Winnipeg Beach thrived on particular courtship rules at the time. Now, you look at the early 20th century, I mean, courtship was something that was done sort of in private. It was done in the parlor. It was maybe done in closed social groups, maybe in your church group, maybe in a class-boundaried social group, maybe even in a work group or something like that. But it wasn't something people necessarily did in public. Hmm. I mean, there wasn't a mass of people going out for dinner and dancing early on in the 20th century, not to public areas anyway.
So when you say private,
and you see signs of that.
When you say private, you mean within the home.
Yeah, within the home, or like I said, within closed social groups. And you kind of see signs of this at Winnipeg. Mm. You see different in-homes, they call them, where you'd see a bunch of people getting together for a gathering and a party. And they actually list off the names in the newspaper. And they're all single. Well, you can't tell if the men are single, but you can tell the women are single because they're all miss. Mm. So you can tell from this. I mean, this is a social mixer. Is what it is. You see signs of that sort of courtship practice going on at Winnipeg Beach. And you also see it in the different picnics and gatherings that were held at Winnipeg Beach in the early 20th century. You know, we're talking 1910 or so.
But something changes by the 1920s.
Yeah, once we get past World War I, we see kind of a shift in courtship practices. And they very much become more public. And you can see this at Winnipeg Beach because the sort of recreation infrastructure explodes. Mm-hmm. The boardwalk expands. The railway station moves back from the lake to allow more space for recreation areas. There's a dance hall is built, and then a bigger dance hall is built. And all these rides are created along the boardwalk. And what that creates is sort of an open public space for men and women to go and to go on a date, or even to go and flirt with other men or flirt with other women.
Now, the boardwalk that you describe here, could you explain to listeners what the sort of practice of socializing recreationally on the boardwalk might have been like in the 1920s?
Well, the notion was you'd probably head up there with a date, or you might head up there if you're a guy, you might head up there with a bunch of your guy friends. If you're a woman, you might head up there with a bunch of your female friends, and the boardwalk was the place where all these groups could meet publicly. Mm. So that the dates could, you know, hold hands, go to the different areas, go to the dance hall, and even the single people mm-hmm. could wander around and they'd do a loop. They could go around the boardwalk in the main street of the town. It was like a sort of a cruising loop that could go on. And they might end up meeting people, you know, probably in the dance hall or something like that.
Now, you argue that this public dating custom or culture of public dating is sort of attributable to the heyday of Winnipeg Beach, but by the 1950s and 1960s, the culture of public dating had shifted and changed the fate for Winnipeg Beach as a resort town?
Yeah. I mean, sort of, you get into the 1950s, and in particular, there was one article I read from about 1960 that sort of, to me, summed up the shift. And it's this supposedly a teenager describing the dating scene at Winnipeg Beach. And he mentions guys driving around checking out girls, and he mentions couples walking on the boardwalk, and that the number of men far outnumbered the number of women, and there was people hanging out in front of the arcades. And he goes on to mention that the rides were all shut down. They weren't running. Nobody was really playing the games. So, I mean, all of this sort of enabling infrastructure that had been there before to make their behavior okay was shut down, and nobody was bothering with it. So it was like the purpose of the boardwalk was laid bare as this dating zone. And yet at the same time, you could clearly see they didn't need it anymore. They could do that sort of thing anywhere. They could drive off. They could pick up a girl. It didn't matter anymore. They went to it because it had been terrain that way, but in some ways it had, they had surpassed it. It didn't need that purpose anymore.
Now,
so by the, and I guess just to wrap that up, so by the 1960s, I mean, public dating was perfectly acceptable. It didn't need the sort of allowances and rules that Winnipeg Beach allowed them to play by.
And it sort of lost its function then as a dating, a site for dating for men and women.
Yeah, because if you wanted to go on a date or if you wanted to get together with a girl, you could do that anywhere. I mean, in the high tide of Winnipeg Beach, if men wanted to head up there and women wanted to head up there and they wanted to stay, chances are they'd stay in separate cabins. So the men would all bunk together with the men, the women would bunk together with the women, and they'd meet on the boardwalk. And that allowed them to play by the rules. You know, they were in separate sleeping places. There was no chance of them having sex, theoretically. So they could play by the rules. I mean, by 1960, you know, I interviewed people, and they said, well, you know, if you wanted to go out to a cabin, you'd get together with some guys and girls, and you'd go out to a cabin somewhere. And it wasn't a big deal. Like, it was just the norm by then.
Now, for those familiar with Manitoba's alcohol history, there's a unique history here to the role that alcohol played in socialization at Winnipeg Beach. Can you explain for listeners what role alcohol played in this social history?
Well, the rules of alcohol were in Manitoba, prohibition lasted from about 1916 to 1923. So you can't get liquor anywhere. From about 1923 to 1928, you could only get liquor in government stores. Finally, in 1928, they say, okay, we'll have beer parlors, you know, so we'll have public drinking again. But men only. Only men can go to the beer parlors. Women can't go to them. And there's no women's section like there was in Ontario. Oddly enough, Winnipeg Beach did flirt with a women's beer parlor, and it was the only place in the province that did this. The owner of the Winnipeg Beach Hotel opened up a women's beer parlor, and it lasted about 2 hours before they shut it down, and that was the end of that. So as far as the dating scene in Winnipeg Beach goes, officially alcohol really played no role, because women didn't go to the beer parlor and had no interest in it. Quite the opposite, really. So that's the official face of alcohol at Winnipeg Beach.
But your oral history evidence shows an unofficial history of alcohol at Winnipeg Beach.
Certainly the oral history shows that, and looking through the newspapers, you can see that boarding house operators periodically got dinged for selling alcohol to their guests. And even if they didn't sell alcohol directly, they'd allow people to drink on their premises. So the boarding houses probably had alcohol in them. You also find that there were a lot of bootlegging houses at Winnipeg Beach. And for a lot, and the way those worked is more or less someone would open up their kitchen or their living room or something like that. And people could go there and they could buy alcohol and they could sit there and have a drink. And you know, apparently there were a fair number of these. And for a lot of them, I mean, they probably served the local community, because, I mean, part of running a bootlegging operation is you don't want to get caught. So if you know your customers, that helps keep you from getting caught. But you can see that some of them did, in fact, serve the guests or, you know, the outsiders who were coming to Winnipeg Beach. Now, the upside of a place like that is that, unlike the beer parlor, men and women can get together and have a drink.
Right.
So they become a social mixing zone. They become a heterosocial zone, as we like to call it.
And the spaces outside the beer parlors were the only heterosocial zones where men and women could drink and socialize.
Exactly, yeah. Mm. And you also see that the dance hall, which was, you could fit about 3,000 people in this dance hall. It was a huge dance hall. Mm-hmm. You can also see that liquor was probably being consumed in it. When you interview the people who worked in the dance hall, they described people coming in either asking for a glass or asking for a Coke or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they knew as they handed this over to them that they were going to be pouring alcohol into it. Or they'd head outside. They'd have a Mickey with them, and they'd head outside and have their drink and then come back in.
So sneaking in a drink into the dance hall or just having a drink outside the dance hall and then coming back in for a dance?
Yeah. So, I mean, even though officially there was no alcohol in the dance hall or around it, mm-hmm. you know, of course there was.
Now, your oral history evidence also reveals some of the gay and lesbian history of socialization at Winnipeg Beach during this period between 1900 and 1967. Can you tell us a little bit about that evidence?
Yeah, one of the neat things about Winnipeg Beach is that I was actually able to tap into a few different oral histories. Mm-hmm. I did a group of my own. I interviewed about 18 people. And about 20 years ago, there was interviews done with people from Winnipeg Beach as a community project. And I think they interviewed about 30 or 35 people. But also about 20 years ago, Manitoba did a gay and lesbian oral history product mm-hmm. or project. And they interviewed a number of gay and lesbian people, and some of them could remember going to Winnipeg Beach. Mm. And it's interesting when you look at their interviews because, you know, as I mentioned, the cabin areas were very much expected to be gender separated. I mean, the notion was you didn't want people doing stuff in the cabins. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, for a group of gay men heading up to Winnipeg Beach, the notion that they're all supposed to stay together in one cabin is not necessarily a bad thing, and it's, you know, if anything, more conducive for getting together and having a good time up there. So the separated nature of the cabin areas, you know, in fact, helped the gay lifestyle up there.
So the cabins created an unsanctioned or an unofficially sanctioned space for gay men and women. But you seem to be clear in the book that the boardwalk itself was very clearly a heterosocial space and one that was, in fact, enforced.
Yeah. You can see people, it was very much expected to be a place for men and women to, mm-hmm. to flirt and date and so forth. And there were almost rules of behavior. I mean, you couldn't be overly masculine. You couldn't be overly aggressive because that would cause problems. For the gay men who headed up there, some of them, I think, and this is my inclination, decided to play with that space a little bit. Because you see the one group, they headed up there, and the guy describes it this way. We were walking along the boardwalk, and he says, we were wearing red women's clogs. And they promptly got chased off the boardwalk by a bunch of guys. And they had to run into a restaurant and hide. And the guy describes that the restaurant owner was quite nice to them. He said, you know, you guys hide here and I'll let you out the back door after they go away. Because they figured they were in for a beating. I mean, it was their concern. Mm-hmm. But again, you could see that they almost seemed to be tweaking the noses of the heterosexual crowd. I mean, we're talking, this was probably 1950s. Right. I think they knew the risk when they headed out there in those red clogs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the boardwalk itself was also a space for heterosexual couples of a particular age. You suggest that this was not a space for children and perhaps not even a space for the very old.
Well, I don't want to exaggerate that because there were children who went on the boardwalk and they went on the beach and older people would have gone there. So it wasn't exclusively a teens and 20-something crowd.
Okay.
Although it probably depended on the time of day. Mm-hmm. You know, during the day, there would have been more kids. You get into the evening when the dance hall is going full steam, and that's when it very much would have been more of a dating crowd sort of culture. So again, timing matters on this. When you get into the evening, you know, the lights are falling, that sort of time, then the teens and 20-somethings come out to play more.
Now, you've suggested that the train was foundational to the creation of Winnipeg Beach, but how did the automobile change the resort?
Well, to go back to the train, I mean, we can think of the train as, you know, it provided a way to reach the resort, but it also provided a way to experience getting to the resort. And this is where I think the kind of social space of the train journey mattered a whole lot. You know, if we think of Winnipeg Beach as a sort of liminal point of gender gathering and nature meeting culture, I think we can also see that sort of liminal experience tracing its way back on the train journey. So in some ways, stepping onto the train in Winnipeg was stepping into this Winnipeg Beach experience. And you see this particularly in the Moonlight Special evening trains up to Winnipeg Beach. These were the trains that headed up there. They'd leave Winnipeg, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 or something like that in the evening, head up to Winnipeg Beach, allow people to walk around on the boardwalk for a couple hours, go for a dance, and then they come back to Winnipeg at around midnight. But you can see the journey out there was, you know, it was potentially, at least, it was a chance for men to flirt with women and the sort of gearing up experience to what Winnipeg Beach was going to be for them. And then on the way home, after, you know, they spent an evening wandering on the boardwalk and dancing and so forth, depending on how much you want to believe some of the sources, the Moonlight Special could get a little rowdy on the way home. The men would flip off the lights and couples would be necking in the train seats and things like that. And like I said, you know, these stories have become part of the mythology of Winnipeg Beach, and they can be a little exaggerated, but we do actually see examples of the paper where men are being charged for shutting off the lights on the Moonlight Special. So the judge is yelling at them. It's, you know, I'm charging you $20 this time, but if you do it again, it's going to be $40. You know, quite angry over this sort of thing. But the notion is the guys are getting a little rowdy.
It sounds like the subway after the bars close in Toronto.
Yeah. So, I mean, so that was very much part of the experience for people of going to Winnipeg Beach. And if you talk to them about Winnipeg Beach, they'll nearly always mention the train rides. The cars, of course, didn't have that experience. The cars didn't have the same social experience of heading up to Winnipeg Beach. They divided people. You know, it wasn't a collective experience anymore. It wasn't a collective anticipation experience anymore. Of course, the cars also did a few simpler things. If we look at the sort of early days of Winnipeg Beach from a raw getting people out there point of view, the car initially helped Winnipeg Beach because the first highway from Winnipeg headed straight up to Winnipeg Beach. Some of the initial crowds, I mean, the car helped them get there. You get into the 1950s as a road network stretches across Manitoba, the competition from other areas hurts Winnipeg Beach because cars can take people anywhere by that point in time.
Right. So families are going to national parks, provincial parks, different
provinces. Yeah, I mean, in Manitoba, you've got Riding Mountain Park. They can get there, no problem. You've got White Shell Park. People can get there, no problem. So there's all sorts of different options. Whereas, you know, under the train, the fact that rail networks only ran to certain places controlled where people could end up going.
So by the end of the 1960s, then, Winnipeg Beach was no longer as popular a recreational destination?
No. And by the, you get into the 1960s, and I mean, some resorts had managed to transition to a family sort of crowd, but they never managed to pull that off at Winnipeg Beach. And I think it's because they were always, they didn't know quite, you know, do we want to keep going for this dating crowd? Do we want to try to draw families? They never quite managed to jump on one side or the other in the 1960s. So it was always sort of terrained as sort of a naughty place to go. And of course, by the 1960s, you know, the infrastructure was starting to run down. So finally the province took it over and more or less bulldozed the entire boardwalk area and created this sort of park-like setting, which ironically, if you look back to what Winnipeg Beach was in about 1903 or something like that, is almost reflective.
This has gone back to its roots.
Yeah, it's almost like it came full circle. And now if you're going to go up to Winnipeg Beach, well, you'll have a picnic with your family or friends or something like that, or you might stare out at the lake or go for a swim, and they've even got a bandstand there.
So in the end, looking at this with a broader lens, do you think that the history of Winnipeg Beach from its origins to its decline is reflective of broader trends in Canadian or even North American social and cultural uses of beaches and waterfront spaces, or is this unique to Manitoba?
I think the phrase I have for it is form follows function. And I think for a lot of these waterfront places, the sort of recreation area, amusement park areas like Winnipeg Beach, a lot of them followed the same sort of arc. And I think it was gender and courtship that really was the engine that drove that arc. So a lot of them thrived under the sort of outpouring of public dating at the beginning of the 20th century as a unique sort of place for people to go, and then sort of died off as having a unique space to go became less necessary. So I think we could look at others and say, yeah, the same sort of arc is in there.
So where is Winnipeg Beach taking you now? What's your current research looking at?
Currently, I'm looking at Toronto's waterfront. But I'm trying to sort of bust out in different directions. I don't really want to do a Winnipeg Beach 2 only in Toronto. So I'm going back a little further. I'm saying, well, how did sort of public swimming beaches, how did they form? And in Toronto, you can look around and you can say, well, a lot of the waterfront, officially people weren't supposed to swim at all. They had rules restricting people from swimming, and then they kind of loosen them up and say, okay, you can swim after dark. And one of the reasons why they've got all these rules is because most of the people that are swimming, well, they're probably men, and B, they're probably swimming without any clothes on. So we have to bridge the gap from that sort of social practice of swimming to when men and women are swimming together, and that's kind of the linkage I'm looking at in Toronto.
Well, it sounds fascinating, and the book is a fantastic read for those interested in broadening their reading on the uses of nature and the environment for recreational purposes. I think this is a fantastic study of beaches and the way in which Canadians used beaches in interesting and fascinating ways in the first half of the 20th century. The book is called Winnipeg Beach, Leisure and Courtship in a Resort Town, 1900 to 1967 by Dale Barber. Dale, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Dale Barber and me, Sean Karash. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes page at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes of the podcast, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave us comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast, and don't forget to rate this podcast and write a short review on our iTunes page. You can follow Nature's Past on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. If you have ideas for new episodes or you want to send me some feedback, contact me through my website at seancarage.com. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community in Canada from the Niche website at niche-canada.org. And you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of Nature's Past.